You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to a special edition of GNAT TV's in-depth series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project. It's a pleasure to have you with us today on Monday, January 10th, for the first in-depth show of the new year. We're pleased to be joined by three of our area state representatives who helped get the new legislative session off to a start last week. We're very pleased to welcome back Kathleen James and Seth Bongartz, who together represent the district that includes Manchester, Arlington, Sandgate, and part of Sunderland, and also Representative David Durfee, whose district includes the other part of Sunderland and Shaftesbury. We may be joined later on by Kelly Piala, who represents a district that includes Windhall, Jamaica, Stratton, Weston, and Windhall, and Londonderry.
Londonderry.
I can't forget Londonderry. But she is not going to be able to join us, at least for the start of the show, so hopefully Kelly will be able to join us a little bit later. But anyway, welcome, everyone. Great to see you all again. Thank you for making the time for this conversation. Really appreciate that. And have you bring us up to speed on what you see as the main issues that the state legislature will be tackling as we go forward into the new session that just began last week. I thought to help us get started today, we could just sort of go around our virtual roundtable here and have each one of you kind of tell us what you think are should be top of mind or what your committees will be working on, at least at the beginning of the session. So I guess I'll just sort of go by the order on my screen here, which means Representative James, will let you start, and then go to Representative Durfee, and then Representative Bongartz, if that would make sense. And So Representative James, tell us what you think are some of the main issues the legislature will or should be tackling as we go forward.
I'll just set the stage by listing the topics that we're all going to want to talk about today, because a very broad consensus has emerged in the legislature, across the state and across the House and Senate about the key topics that we need to really try to make some progress on in 2022. So hopefully we'll have time to dig more deeply into these, but the kind of interconnected challenges of housing, workforce, and childcare, which are all in a real state of kind of crisis right now. These are longstanding problems in our state that were exacerbated by COVID. And so housing, workforce, and childcare, we all are looking forward to making progress on solving our pensions crisis. And hoping that we can find a way to address that unfunded liability, in a way that's fair to our hardworking state employees and teachers, and also fair to taxpayers. So that'll be top of mind. The legislature is going to have a lot of work to do to start moving forward many of the recommendations in the climate plan that was released in December. And then we've got a lot of issues that we're going to be focusing on in the Education Committee, where I serve. Including education finance and implementing some of the recommendations of the so-called and famous waiting study that was delivered by UVM and other researchers in December. So I don't want to, there's a lot I could say, but let's go around and then we can dive into any of these more deeply.
All right. Thank you, Representative James. So, Representative Durfee, over to you. What's looming large from your standpoint?
Kathleen covered most of the of our seven-month agenda, I think, coming up for the legislature. Possibly left out two constitutional amendments that we're going to be taking a second vote on this session, Proposal 2 and Proposal 5, both of which the legislatures, both the House and the Senate, the legislature approved 2 years ago. And the Constitution requires that we take a second vote in a new biennium. So we're doing that this year. And those votes then will go to the, to be voted on by everyone in the state in November. and they are, just to be clear. The first is clarity on banning slavery in Vermont. This goes back to language in the Constitution that we wanted to just make sure was absolutely clear. And then the second is reproductive liberty for women, and that comes, of course, on the heels of concerns federally in the Supreme Court about Roe v. Wade. So we'll be taking those up sometime quickly, I think, and then they'll be on to the rest of Vermont to finalize and approve in November. I'll just mention in one other thing in my committee, Ways and Means, that's already come up. We are, just for a little context, the state is in a very strong, an extraordinarily strong position financially at the moment. There's a surplus of on the order of, I think, $180 million over what was budgeted. And that's extraordinary, given the overall size of our budget. And there's of course, lots of potential uses for that funding. It's one-time funding. It's not as though we are projecting going out into the future that we'll have that much money coming in every year over what we currently expect. But it is a large amount of money. So lots of different ways of using it. We're currently beginning to have a conversation in House Ways and Means Committee about a possible Vermont-specific child tax credit. And this is not a credit that currently exists. It would be a new credit. Child tax credit is in the news a lot at the moment because federally there's been an ongoing discussion about whether to extend the expanded child tax credit under what we all perhaps heard is the Build Back Better bill, which is, I think, lacks one vote to pass at the moment in the Senate. So there's still a possibility of that. But this would be a Vermont credit. And it was a bill that was introduced, a bipartisan bill, and it would be modest. I think we're looking at, according to the language in the bill, $1,200 annually for children through age six, and it would phase out at higher incomes. But parents would be eligible for it, whether or not they set their kids to childcare. It wouldn't be a reimbursement for childcare. It would be above and beyond that. There wouldn't be a work requirement. It would basically be every family would be eligible. So that's one. In addition to all the ways that the money could be spent, that's another possibility that we're looking at.
All right. Well, a lot to dive into there for sure, and we will definitely have an opportunity to explore some of that more. It's as you say, it's certainly interesting for the state to be in such a robust financial situation over so many years. It seemed like every year the deficit was kind of a big part of the story, and how we're going to retire that. But it seems like the other way around this year, which I'm sure.
Yeah, typically we get to this point in the year, and there's 40, 60, 80 million dollars in that needs to be found to cover expenses that hadn't been anticipated, and so we're in a very different situation this year.
All right. Well,
Dave, I know it's Seth's turn, but Dave, that's general fund surplus, not counting the ed fund, right? Which has its own $100 million dollar surplus.
Right, right.
Unbelievable.
And Seth, we will give you a chance, but
maybe not. I'll
just mention that there's a surplus in the education fund, which is likely also going to result in lower property tax bills next summer and fall across the state. And of course, that depends on what local school districts decide to spend. But the sort of the base amount right now looks like bills will be lower.
All right. Well, Representative Bongartz, over to you then. What's on your top of your list that you'd like to see the legislature get their arms around?
Well, I think we've, this always happens, of course, that that you ask the big issues, and the big issues have kind of been covered. One we haven't touched on, and it's there, is reapportionment. Another major issue that we can, again, we can talk about a little bit later whenever you're ready to talk about that in more detail. In my committee, we'll be dealing with, I'm involved in three particular pieces of legislation in my committee. One of them is the housing bill that Kathleen and I put together, and actually Dave signed on to, that came partially out of the housing conference that we had in Arlington. And it is to make it easier to, without going into detail, it's got its own levels of complexity, but the idea is to make it easier to do infill development in downtowns and actually in so-called neighborhood development areas, easier to do housing development. So that bill, I think, is going to be the bill that is sort of the lead housing bill in the House. Has that feel, and it will, I'm pretty sure it will be coming out of my committee, because a lot of it has to do with regulatory changes that set up. And there is money now for housing, and so if we can set up the lay the groundwork to make it easier for housing to happen, that will be a real plus for our communities. I'm also working on a forestry bill that is connected to the climate change, and it was one of the recommendations that came out of the commission is for Vermont to return some of its forest to old growth forests as a means of gathering carbon sequestration, carbon storage, and biodiversity. They all go together. And that bill, it would be done by utilizing the current use program to make it possible for people to maintain forests for that purpose, as opposed to always for cutting timber. So that's one of them. I've also been working with my committee chair over the summer. Amy Sheldon and I have worked on an Act 250 governance bill that is getting attention in my committee right now. Actually, all three of those bills are getting attention in my committee. So that's where I'll be spending a lot of my time, although obviously all 180 of us are going to be paying attention to the big issues. That your introductory question was about the big issues, and we'll all be focused on those at the same time. And then all of us within our committee focused on, work that's in front of us there.
Okay. A lot we can talk about here as we kind of drill down maybe into some of the details and whatnot. I'm tempted to continue the conversation about housing. But I think before we jump into that further, I wanted to ask you all about what you think about this workforce issue that seems to also have been brought to the surface. Governor Scott mentioned that extensively in his State of the State message last week about the need to increase the number of workers in the workforce, and particularly those who might be tempted to go into vocational trades, electricians, carpenters, plumbers, construction work, that sort of thing. And of course, this is tied in very closely to the housing question and also the childcare issue, which is another thing I wanted to talk about or hear your views on how we fix that. But maybe we could start by just hearing what you each think about how we might go about solving some of the workforce issues. I know part of that's demographic related, but Is there some measure you think would help kind of increase the flow of students going into vocational trades beyond what we're seeing now, or is there some other solution out there that you think might be more effective? And I guess I'll just let anyone who wants to start.
Well, I can start just because I think we're each going to have, this is a really complex problem. And so we're going to have to come at it from a lot of different ways. So, I can just talk in a more narrow way about two of the areas that I've been working on. One is that we did fund last year through the Vermont State Colleges a it was either a new program or a greatly expanded program, and it's called the Critical Occupations Scholarships. And those scholarships offered, you know, like I said, through the Vermont State Colleges, they target a list of occupations that are deemed to be critical to Vermont's economy. And they offer basically last dollar tuition for those fields. So, you know, you can basically get those degrees for free. And this money that we awarded last year, and I'm sorry, I can't remember how much it was, but it was a significant chunk of money, was used up very quickly. And the Vermont State Colleges have come back to the legislature asking for a re-up of that funding. So, you know, I think targeted scholarships that try to connect students, you know, Vermont students, with the money they need to enter the fields that we need the most. Also, too, I think there's been a lot of talk already in the legislature about our career and technical education centers, and that's an issue that I'm very interested in. And we've got a couple bills before the Education Committee right now, bipartisan bills that I introduced, but really just introduced them because they are, you know, they're kind of the growing consensus or following up of the work that the Agency of Education has been doing and Commerce has been doing. And it really gets to the fact that we need to really take a hard look at how we fund and govern and organize our career and technical education centers like Southwest Tech to attract more students and make it easier for students to attend and really start building those pipelines, you know, to the skilled trades and other fields that are good paying jobs and could really keep a lot of people, funnel a lot of students right out of high school, you know, into certificate programs or apprenticeships or two-year degrees that will prepare them to work in Vermont quickly. So those are two little pieces that I've been thinking about.
All right. Well, Representative Durfee, over to you. Any thoughts on that? I mean, Southwest Tech, of course, is just down the road from you there in Bennington, and have played an important role in helping students get started in those sorts of trades.
Yeah, Southwest Tech serves the entire Bennington County area, and including, you know, Northshire towns. The governor, I think, is when he brought this up, was specifically talking about structural, fundamental, long-term problems, and we're also facing a more short-term workforce problem right now that we see every day in the schools, for example, when staff are calling out sick and there aren't enough substitutes to call on to bring in, and so there's a, you know, possibility that schools might have to close on short notice. And we're seeing it in restaurants not being open the number of hours that they used to be because they don't have the staffing to be open 7 days a week or past a certain time in the evening. So that's a stressful situation, I think, for lots of, obviously in this case of schools, extremely stressful. But it just sort of adds to the general stress that people are feeling, I think, right now, and I think there are lots of things contributing to that, and that will eventually pass, maybe with some adjustments. Maybe things won't look exactly the way they used to, but we'll still be faced with those long-term structural concerns that the governor talked about. I think that we've identified, when we dig into it a little bit, that part of the issue is finding enough people to train a new group of nurses, for example. There aren't enough teachers to teach in those programs. At the technical center, Southwest Tech, the instructors for programs come and go. The forestry program is looking for someone to lead it after the person who was leading that moved on fairly recently. That's happened over the years with the agriculture program and probably with other programs too. So not unfortunately able to offer a solution to that other than starting up by recognizing that it is part of the challenge. I think also when you're talking about plumbing and electricians and other what we think of as traditional trades, we may need to look at what's required beyond the sort of education that you might get at the tech center. In order to become an electrician, what regulatory issues do we need to take a look at? I think that it's set up right now so that it's there's some high hurdles to get over, and I'm not certain whether there are easy ways to solve that issue, but something at least to look at as well. We've been talking about this goes back to the redistricting question. Towns are right now seeing increases in their property values, and when the time comes, as it does at this time of year, to set tax rates, they look at how much of residential sales values change versus what's listed as your property value. And when that gets to be too high or too low, you need to do a reappraisal. And there aren't appraisers in Vermont. And becoming an appraiser is something that's not easy to do. So it's everywhere.
Mm. Seth, did you want to have anything further you wanted to add to that before we move on to the subject? I mean,
it's an unbelievably important issue, as anybody who's tried to get somebody to come do some work in their house knows, which is all of us, I suspect. And, you know, to pick up on Dave's theme a little bit, we might want to we might need to help people get their certificates or their training for being a plumber and a electrician, some of those key trades. We might, to grease the skids a little bit to make it easier for people to survive while they're going through that stage of getting their licensure. We also, and you mentioned it, Andrew, at the beginning, everything's connected. Housing, daycare, making it possible for people to work, is connected. And we've got it's funny to think about this, but with the housing crisis we have in Vermont right now, we also have the same demographic problem we had before all of this hit us, I forget the exact numbers, but Vermont has gone from something like 120,000 school children 20 years ago to more like 80 now. And we've picked up a few, it's picked up a little bit because of COVID and people moving here, but we've got that demographic problem. It's also part of the reason we don't have people stepping into the void to take, to take the next level of, take the positions after people retire. And so everything is connected. Everything's connected. We got to tackle everything.
That's for sure. Well, let's pick up on one of those things that's connected, childcare. An awful lot of talk about childcare provider shortages. I mean, this is a problem that predated the arrival of the pandemic. I guess I'm just wondering, Representative James, let me turn to you. Is there some of the federal ARPA or relief money going to be channeled towards trying to help alleviate that situation? I mean, it seems to me, anyway, that a lot of the conversation seems to eventually come back to the point that child care providers are paid very little. I mean, you can get a job at a convenience store and make more money than you can at a child care center, it seems like, from what I understand. So that right there is kind of a big disincentive, I'm sure, for a lot of people who might ordinarily, find that career path attractive. But I guess, is there any approach do you see happening out of the legislature this year that might attempt to alleviate this problem?
Well, maybe Dave and Seth know more than I do about, what we've been able to talk about just in the past week that we've been in session. But, we passed a really comprehensive bill last year, H-171, that is, putting us on a path to, I think, really make some progress in solving all of those problems that you just talked about. H-171 is going to increase eligibility for child care subsidies for low and moderate income families. So it's going to make more families eligible for help with their child care. And its ultimate goal is that no Vermont family pay more than 10% of their income on childcare. And they've commissioned a study to come back on that about how we would structure that and how we would pay for it. And I think that study is not due until next year. So basically taking a look at the affordability challenge of childcare, how families can not, you know, can afford it, basically. And then in terms of the workforce, H-171 also is, you know, provided some funding for to support early educators, I think with some scholarship support or maybe help with loan repayment. I can't remember which, or maybe it's both. And so it takes a look at that aspect of, you know, the workforce challenge as well. So sort of coming at it from those two points of view. How do we support the workforce, the early childhood workforce, and how do we support families? And there were more things that H-171 accomplished. It was really kind of a landmark childcare bill. And then I believe that we did authorize emergency stabilization grants from ARPA money, Dave or Seth might know, for childcare providers. And those funds were, I think childcare centers have already applied, and they're going to be receiving the funds, I believe it was monthly over the next year. So I guess the question is, you know, what to build on that work, what can we do this session? And I would assume that the Human Services Committee is going to be taking a pretty hard look at that as they get up and running.
All right. Anyone else want to weigh in on this one before we move on, since we got a lot of topics to cover?
I think you actually covered it, Kath.
I just one more thing to add to it is we must, and Kathleen kind of said it, but we must pay providers more. The cycle right now is that they can't afford to charge more because people can't afford to pay more. But on what they're charging, they can't afford to pay their help anything like a livable wage or benefits or anything else. So it is like, on the one hand, we've turned it into one of the worst professions in the world, when in fact it's one of the great professions. But we have to fund it. And we're going to have to put real money into this system. But the Vermont economy, in addition to what it will do for kids, the Vermont economy will never run on all eight cylinders until we do it. And that has to happen. And that really is what H-171 was also about, was bringing them up to something like parity for pay. And we've got to do that, or the system is not going to work.
Mm. Right. And of course, the pandemic has really highlighted all of that, when many parents have had to make very difficult choices around going to work or staying home to watch the kids. So a big problem we are definitely going to have to solve. Just moving along, I guess I also wanted to ask you all what you thought the legislature might be doing in terms of kind of next steps on the climate action plan that the Climate Council kind of came up with a proposal for, I believe, back on December 1st, following up the Global Warming Solutions Act, where the state is committed to reducing greenhouse gas pollution to, I think it's 26% below 2005 levels by 2025, which all of a sudden is right around the corner and not that far away. That 26% below 2005 levels sounds like a lot. I mean, maybe it isn't, but that's, I guess I'm just wondering, are there some, do you see whichever committee is going to wind up tackling this, coming up with a plan to follow up on that report the Climate Council produced, or where does that stand at the present?
Well, committees, I think that this week you can look to the House to be rolling out sort of the broad outlines of its climate plan for 2022. You know, it's incumbent upon the legislature. The climate plan included 200 some recommendations or proposals or strategies to help Vermont meet the carbon, you know, the carbon reduction goals that were set out in the Global Warming Solutions Act that are now requirements. And a lot of those recommendations in the climate plan do fall to the legislature to enact. So I think some of the big bills this year that you'll see, and also the legislature set aside, you know, $100 million worth of ARPA funding in kind of a bucket to use to fund these initiatives. So I think you'll see big initiatives coming out of the legislature this year on weatherization. The kind of catchphrase for that is weatherization at scale. The goal, and I don't know whether this will wind up in the final bill, but one goal that I heard kicking around was that we want to weatherize 90,000 homes by, can't remember the date, sorry. But so to really beef up the amount of money that we're spending on weatherizing homes, which has a workforce component, right? Those are good paying skilled jobs, and also helps Vermonters save money on their heating and energy bills. Transportation is going to be a huge focus. There's a very broad transportation bill that's already been in the works that I think we all signed off on, all three of us probably co-sponsored, that will look to expand incentives to help Vermonters get into more fuel-efficient vehicles and expand charging infrastructure. I think we'll be talking about the Clean Heat Standard, which would require Vermont fuel dealers at the wholesale level, I think that's really important to understand, to deliver sort of an increasingly higher percentage of clean heat solutions to Vermonters as the years go on. And then obviously how we use our land, how we build smart, you know, according to the principles of smart growth so that we cluster development downtown. And then a lot of work to do with sustainable ag as well and carbon sequestration.
I guess there's other elements to this as well. Environmental justice, I guess, and municipal resilience is another area that I believe came up. So a lot to follow there. That's going to be a really fascinating conversation to see how that moves forward. Well, let's.
No, Andrew, one quick thing before we move on from this.
Yeah.
You know, people sometimes think about all of this as expense, but I think it's really important to keep in mind how much money we send out of state now for things like fuel oil and gasoline. And it's hundreds of millions of dollars. And I forget that Jim Sullivan gave me a number for Bennington County. And I don't dare repeat it because it sounds like it's so high, I can't have it right. But we've got to keep in mind, we're the potential here is to keep a hell of a lot of money in state, that we're now sending out of state for fuel. And, you know, reversing that is a huge benefit to Vermont. So we should keep that in mind as we're looking at all the factors that go into this. I just wanted to bring that up.
All right. Absolutely. I was wondering, let's turn to that reapportionment question. One of you mentioned it earlier in our conversation here. And you'll have to remind me about the history of this now. There are two reports that are out there, right, that the Legislative Apportionment Board came up with. As we all know, every 10 years, the legislature gets reapportioned, and the Legislative Apportionment Board came up with one plan that was endorsed by four of its seven members, and then another plan that was in the minority report, I guess you could call it, were endorsed by the other three. What are the differences between the two plans, and kind of what happens next? Because this is kind of something that has to get decided fairly quickly, I think, right, in view of the fact that the census data was kind of late coming in because of COVID. And yet I think it's by April, right, if I'm not mistaken, April 1st or so, that we have to have the new district lines drawn. So this is something that's going to, I'm assuming, going to be kind of one of the earlier subjects you all will be tackling. But I guess... Would one of you like to kind of walk us through what's going on?
I can jump in just to give some sort of general comments on it. And as you said, there's a deadline coming up. And typically the legislature would be much further along in the process. Everything was delayed because of the pandemic, and the Legislative Apportionment Board wasn't able to start its work when it normally would have, because it didn't have population counts from the Census Bureau. because the census was delayed in getting those counts. So everyone was behind the eight ball. It's a seven-member committee, and they are charged with coming up with a map that divides Vermont into 150 house districts, or 100 that represents 150 representatives, and then 30 senators. And so they did that, and they did turn a map in, but they weren't all in agreement. And there was, as you said, there were four of the board members who approved one map, and then one set of maps, and then there was a minority report that had a different approach. And they're different in many ways. I guess maybe the most significant difference is that one of the maps has the entire state broken into 150 single member house districts, and the other map doesn't take that approach. And right now and historically, Vermont has not had entirely single member house districts. So for example, the district that I represent has about 4,200 people living in it, and it is a single member district. The district that Kathleen and Seth are in has two representatives, two of them, and it has a population about twice that. And there are lots of reasons why that might make sense, depending on the other considerations, geographic considerations being one of them, political, social and cultural boundaries. So historically, there have been, rather than 150 districts in Vermont, there have been maybe 100, 110, 120. I'm not sure exactly how many there are now, but many of them are two-member districts. So that's probably the biggest difference. And as far as where we are in the process, again, there's a deadline coming up, and we ought to be farther along than we are. So the House committee that works on this is the Government Operations Committee, and they already jumped into it. They were working on it before we started last week. They put a lot of time into it this past week, and they're going to be, I think, on Tuesday, actually, voting out a proposal that would take this second map and the alternative map and send it out to towns for another round of feedback. So local communities have already had a chance to weigh in on one map. And I think the House is interested in hearing how towns feel about this other approach. It's a starting point. It's not the map that we'll be ending up with. And again, these are conversations with towns that would have taken place ideally in October, November. And so they're going to be, it'd be important to have those conversations quickly and for towns to be looking at the map whatever that map looks like when it comes out next week.
Now, those maps just refer to the House of Representatives, right? The State Senate is not a part of that?
There are Senate maps as well. And I, to be honest, I'm not as up to speed on those, but it's the same. And the Senate deals with those. So we work with ours, and the Senate deals with theirs.
Right. We need to have Senator Campion or Sears on our panel to get the informed update on that, I guess. I guess I'm just wondering, I the argument around two-member districts is that it gives residents like an unfair advantage. It gives people like me, who lives in Sunderland, access to two representatives as opposed to just one. Is that... that's the criticism that has been made of it, or the idea that it doesn't give equal representation to all citizens? Is that the main criticism?
I'm not sure that I should speak for that argument, because I'm not sure that's what it is, but I think that's the general, possibly the general concern that if you live in Sunderland, which has, I mean, part of the Sunderland is its own special case,
because you have
three of us in the delegation. Yeah. But if you live in Manchester, say maybe a better example, that you've got, you know, two people who you can call on, or Arlington has two people it can call on, which might give it an advantage. The Constitution does the state Constitution doesn't come out obviously in one or the other direction. It says the 2-member districts are allowed, or it doesn't say they're not allowed. So I guess there's that.
You know, it's funny. And this is not an issue. I'm Seth and I both said I'm very glad I'm not on the GovOps committee and that I'm, you know, not directly involved in reapportionment. I mean, we'll vote on whatever the committee brings to the floor, but you know, we're not. This is not really our, you know, our bailiwick. But it's interesting. I have been, you know, reading the articles and thinking about the benefits of the draw and the drawbacks of 1 versus 2-member districts. And you know, there are upsides and downsides to both. I think about, you know, sort of a hypothetical district where, you know, maybe 60% of Democrats are voters. I mean, yeah, 60% of voters are Democrats, just for an example. And if that's a single member district, the minority party would have a very hard time, I would think, you know, maybe finding a voice or electing a Republican. If you have a 2-member district, there, it seems to me that there would be a better chance of maybe, you know, electing 2 members of 2 parties or something like that. So I don't really know. I know there are studies that have been done on, you know, which are more representative, and they come out on both sides. I think really in our case, it has quite a lot to do also with not splitting towns down the middle. That's something that town clerks don't like, and it's confusing for voters, and it's not great for reps. So I think that concern that we not chop a bunch of towns in half is worth, that merits consideration as well.
And just one other thing to add on to what Kathleen said, the other thing that merits consideration is which towns are put together with what other towns. And, you know, we have the situation, as you know, Andrew, as a resident of Sunderland, where the initial map had Sunderland connected to the district over the mountain by virtue of the fact you actually border Stratton, although you can't get there from here. And so those are the kinds of things that also have to get taken into consideration, because Sunderland under the initial map, this is just an example, but would be totally stranded. So those are the kinds of things that all have to get worked into this, as Kathleen uses the term, and I think appropriately, it's a Rubik's Cube. And sometimes you get to the best solution by mixing 1 and 2-member districts. So we'll see. We're not that involved in it. It's the GovOps committee. So we'll see.
Let me just turn to one other issue. It's kind of related to the housing issue, which I'd like to get back to before we have to run. But I was also wondering about Act 250. Is that going to be a subject for discussion revision this year? It's a very complicated piece of legislation. I know the legislature has struggled over the last couple of years to come up with a revision for the now more than 50-year-old legislation initially passed in, I think it was in 1970, back when I was in college, which was a very, 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 very long time ago. Is there anything happening on that front, do you think, that might work its way through the legislature this year? Or is that just one of those things that's just too complicated right now? And I ask because I think it does tie in a way to the housing question we've sort of discussed a little bit. Talking to some developers, it sounds like one of the things that slows down housing development is concerns about getting snarled in the Act 250 process and appeals that they have to work through. Before I go any further, is that an accurate criticism, do you think, or a connection? And if so, do we need to kind of tweak Act 250 to kind of solve the housing problem? And Seth, maybe I'll go to you and see what your thoughts on that, because I know you've this has been something you've thought about a lot.
Well, a couple of pieces to this. One, you know, the bill that Kathleen and Dave and I have all put in together does make it easier and less complicated, and does not have active future jurisdiction for some aspects of housing in the downtown and housing in the technically called housing, neighborhood development areas. But I think overall, there is a, the legislature is reluctant to have Act 250 exemptions as a rule, because everything, as we just said earlier, for other things is connected. But the bill that I've put in that I think will come out of my committee really deals with Act 250 governance, and I think that has been a big part of the problem. When we eliminated, when the state eliminated the Environmental Board 15 or 16 years ago, and it had everything go to court, for reasons that are complex to get into, what that has resulted in is very little oversight. The district, there's not precedent being set by Environmental Board decisions, but then filtered down to district commissions for uniformity of thinking and uniformity of decision making. And so the bill that we're putting, that we have introduced, and I think will come out of my committee, reintroduces, rather than have appeals go to the environmental court where there's no precedent set, because district courts do not have any precedent attached to any of their decisions. So in a way, what's happened is that the district commissions have been left hanging out there without any guidance. And that has made the process less efficient and less uniform. And then by the time you have to go to the environmental court with appeals, you're in a court system where it's technical and there's discovery and it's expensive and it goes on for a long time. That's part of the problem. And if we can restore the part of the process that had, this is similar to what was the old environmental board, providing guidance down through the system, you get a much more uniform and I think a much more efficient and actually, more expeditious, if you will, system that can help alleviate some of the systems. The other thing, by the way, is the other problem is we haven't funded it. We have starved it and then complained that it's not working well. We don't have coordinators in every district. We don't have offices in every district. We don't have administrative staff. And we've got to fund it. If we're going to be, if we want it to work, we have to fund it at a level that allows the wheels to turn. So those are part of it. There are other bills in, like you were kind of alluding to, that would, try to exempt this or that from Act 250. But I think there's not a lot of appetite for a lot of exemptions. I think what makes much more sense is to make the process work well.
All right. Moving on. Before we move on from there, is there anything further we want to talk about on the housing front? Because I feel like, that's been like one of the biggest issues that has been confronting the state. And again, something that's preceded the pandemic was an issue and a problem well before 2020. It just seems like, as we said at the beginning, all these things are kind of connected. We want to increase the workforce. We want to help the demographic picture get better. So many young residents of Vermont can't afford to buy a home or even rent an apartment because there's just not enough of them around. What is it simply a question of just simply pumping a lot of the ARPA or federal money into housing bonds to incentivize developers to create more affordable and workforce housing? Or is it a bigger problem that it seems like you keep on running into this situation with the developers that say, well, it's just not, it's not financially rewarding to build low-cost housing. I mean, it's just you can't make any money doing that. So how do we fix that?
You can, and they do. That's where the priority housing projects come in, and that connects back to the bill that three of us put in to make it easier to have the towns have priority housing projects where the requirement is 20% of low-income units, and there is subsidy for that that helps close the gap. And so that's one way, and you've said it, we have a lot of money for the first time in ages. We've got some money to put into housing. And I can't remember the number that was put in last year, but I know that, we still have $500 million sitting there that we held back on until we knew it was in an infrastructure bill at the federal level. And what might have come out of the Build Back Better if any of that had passed, but I guess it's not going to. But, there will be more money put into housing, by the way. Also, money for sewer and water, which is connected to housing. So we've got a real opportunity to make a dent in it. And you know, and as you, maybe you didn't quite say this, but I know you're it's part of the conversation. It's not just technically affordable housing that we need. It's also the sort of middle income housing. But we've got a real opportunity in front of us. And so we have to lay the groundwork for it. And then we've got to pump money in, but we have some money. So I'm, you know, I think we can make some progress.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I was just trying to look through my notes while we were talking. I know that the House General Housing and Military Affairs Committee has already started taking testimony this past week on investments we can make, you know, in both helping, you know, helping folks who are experiencing homelessness. So, you know, supporting that community to find housing and then affordable housing. So those are two areas that we've have pumped a lot of money into and are going to continue to do that using those ARPA funds. So, you know, you want to support housing with investments all along the spectrum. So, you know, when you help people who are experiencing homelessness find permanent housing, that's obviously an important piece of the puzzle. And then you want to help low-income Vermonters, you know, purchase homes or be stable in their rental apartments. And then, as Seth said, to also try to figure out a way to help folks, you know, more moderate-income Vermonters in the so-called sort of missing middle be able to get into home ownership as well. And so I'm not going to be able to find it in time, but I had just seen the numbers for what the what the housing committee is looking at in the budget adjustment, I believe, to try to move some of those things along quickly. And I think that the Scott administration did propose a pilot this year for missing middle housing, a $5 million pilot, which is interesting, and that would be a new area for us.
Turning quickly to another issue I think was mentioned earlier by one of you, and it was a big discussion point you know, a year or two ago, and well, probably been for a long time now, pension reform. My understanding is the legislature is going to put in about $150 million in some of the one-time money to help alleviate the deficit in the state workers' pension fund. Is that going to be kind of enough to kind of tide things over for now, or is there anything further we need to know about on that front?
I think it's probably not enough to entirely tie things over, but it's an ongoing conversation and discussion. I think that we should be hearing something from the committee of jurisdiction there fairly soon. And the what I've heard is that the plan right now, excuse me, one second. The plan right now doesn't reduce. The plan would be not to reduce the benefit at all for retired state employees and teachers. So the details are still to be made clear to us, I think, but that's the general outline.
What happens if enough money isn't found to sort of keep things going forward? I mean, if the system went bankrupt, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean that state employees don't get paid their pensions? Is that
line? Yeah. I mean, I guess if in fact that happened, I don't think that's going to happen. Thank you for shaking your head and in agreement. I think, Kathy.
It's not going to happen.
I mean, that's an extreme scenario. What would happen instead is we would continue to just fund it out of the general fund of the state budget, and it's already, you know, exceeding, I think, 10% of that budget. It's a large chunk of what we currently spend. So we're trying to get the whole point of this process is trying to get a handle on that.
And I'm feeling more optimistic. You know, as Dave said, the task force that's been working on this has representatives from the legislature and from the state employees union and from the teachers union. And I think in recent weeks they have been working especially hard to strike a deal you know, and so if, you know, if the legislature is presented with a plan that the state employees and the teachers and the legislature and folks from the pension board have all agreed to, that'll be a big, big, big step forward.
I'll just add one thing, Andrew. You asked the question specifically about whether us putting money in, the legislature putting money in, will do it. And the answer is no. We'll never be able to buy our way out of this. So it's going to have to be the compromise to which, some sort of compromise to which Kathleen was alluding. But I have the same. I think there's a real want on the part of the legislature to deal with this now. And to state the obvious, we all know it. But the longer you don't deal with it, the more expensive it gets to deal with it. The deeper you have to do whatever you have to do. So dealing with it now is the time. And I think we're going to.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time, but I just wanted to wrap things up with one quick, have you all tell us a little bit about the bill that the legislature has already passed, which related to a town meeting day, all of a sudden coming up not too far down the road in a couple of months. Last year, as we all remember, we went through, some town meetings occurred in May or June or later in the year, some were remote. What does the bill, I think it's S-172, does that just sort of carry over some of the practices from last year and allows towns to have remote town meetings or delay them again this year if, next month or so, COVID is still, and the Omicron variant is still wreaking havoc? Is that basically what that does?
Flexibility with three options. Towns can hold their town meeting in person as normal. They can delay it, and the hope there would be that it's warmer and they can have it outside or something. Or they can do an informational meeting remotely, so folks could log on Zoom to talk about stuff and then vote by Australian ballot. Those are the three choices. And I think those are the same three choices as last year, and different communities did different things, you know, whatever works for their voters.
Well, hopefully we'll be back to normal. That would be nice to have a traditional floor meeting and folks saying yay or nay from the floor, as opposed to whatever else you might want to do. Well, unfortunately, we're going to leave it there for now. Several other questions we'll have to save for another time. Maybe after town meeting, we'll have you all come back again and say, well, so far we've done this, we've done that, and then something else is coming along. But anyway, I wanted to thank all three of you again for making the time for this conversation today. Representative Kathleen James, Representative David Durfee, and Representative Seth Bongartz, really appreciate your time today and your service to the state. And, we'll be in touch and see you all again on our virtual roundtable again real soon, I hope.
Good.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks, Jeanette.
All right. Thanks for having us.
And thanks to all of you for being with us today. I hope you found our program interesting. And, we'll see you again the next time when we have these folks back. Meanwhile, have a great day. Take care.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.